tonight on the title of this evening's discussion is about currywurst and tofu. I'm quite sure that we don't talk the whole evening about currywurst, but being a German, I think it needs some words to the American audience about the currywurst, because this is something very special German. And it's kind of a fusion food. You don't eat it in a restaurant. You eat it on the street with a paper plate below and with some plastic spoon on the top. And it's fusion because it's a sausage in essence. And you know Germans die for sausages. And but it's not only a pure sausage. It's with ketchup, so it has a kind of transatlantic notion too. And it's curry. Curry is difficult. I think I would say it's Indian influence. Some say it's British. You never know. The same way you know don't know what is in the sausage, you know don't know really where the curry is coming from. But there's one interesting figure why the currywurst is so important. The Germans eat 800 million currywursts per year. This is so we have to eat 10 per person per year, which is quite kind of stressful. But there is but there is also a contradictive trend to that. Recently, there was a kind of a research that the better-offs in Germany eat less food than those people with lower incomes. So you have a kind of reverse trend also. But what that means, I think that's part of the panel. They can't figure out what that really means. So I leave it by that. I just briefly introduce our moderator who has joined us tonight. It's Eric Asadourian. He is a senior fellow at the World Watch Institute. The World Watch Institute is a pretty well-known in town here, worldwide operating independent research organization, pretty well recognized in also in other countries. And the Institute has mainly three areas of work. It's climate and energy, food and agriculture, and green economy. And you see this is very much overlapping what our foundation does, and so it's no wonder we are a partner of very many events over the year, publications, etc. Eric was director of State of the World 2010. I think it's fair to say this is kind of a flagship publication of the World Watch Institute, and we have the honor to translate that into German and to present it every year to the German audience. I leave it by that and hand over to Eric. I have two technical remarks to make. First, there is a book sale outside, and of course the authors are happy about a high turnout on the table over there. And there will be a reception, so don't run away. Make use of the reception. There is even a mixture of currywurst and tofu. it will be delicious. Eric, thank you.
Thanks, Klaus. And thanks both to the Heinrich Böll Foundation and the Goethe Institute for hosting this, co-hosting this. It's very exciting. In fact, what Klaus didn't mention is that the New York Times devoted an entire page last week to currywurst. So this is clearly resonating. Maybe they are in the audience now, I'm not sure. Before I continue, and thank you all also for coming out tonight, and the panelists, of course, I want to quickly introduce both panelists now, and then I'm going to ask a few kind of introductory questions to start the conversation, but very quickly I want to shift the burden to you all and start getting the questions coming from the audience so that this will be really an engaging forum. But don't worry, I have many questions of my own, so I might steal back the floor here and there. Let me just quickly introduce Tanya, who I actually had the great pleasure of meeting in March of last year when I was in Berlin at the Heinrich Böll Foundation to launch the German edition of State of the World. Tanya is a journalist and author of two books that I think are very connected to this topic, The Shopping Revolution, Consumers Discover Their Power, and The Dictatorship of the Food System, Why We Should Not Eat More of What Our Industry Serves Up. The latter book, I think, is highly connected right here and really talks about how food has become standardized and more of our food is being created from the same raw materials, which is undermining our health and, of course, the health of the planet. What you probably don't know about Tanya is that along with studying journalism, she actually studied philosophy and wrote her thesis on how the media was addressing the coming millennium and the end of the world kind of elements that have really captured the popular mind back in the late 90s, which I'm guessing is what prepared you to study the food industry. Yeah. Thank you for being here, Tanya.
Thanks for the introduction.
And Mark Nguyen is a food activist and former executive director of the Hartford Food System for over 20 years, and the co-founder of the Community Food Security Coalition, and also the author of two books. The first, Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty, and the second, Food Rebels, Guerrilla Gardeners, and Smart Cooking Mamas, Fighting Back in an Age of Industrial Agriculture. And I think that's on sale outside.
It is. It better be.
Mark actually doesn't know this, but I actually grew up in the Hartford area, right outside of Hartford, West Hartford, and remember fondly trips to the Hartford Farmers Market as a child. And so thanks, a personal thanks to all your work to help cultivate a sustainable food market there, a food system there. Unfortunately, most of my diet as a kid consisted of Fritos and Chips Ahoy cookies, but I think that seed of healthy vegetables helped to transform my diet as an adult.
I understand they just introduced currywurst to the farmer's market.
Anything's possible. So let me just dive right in for questions. I will start with you, Mark. As some of us in the audience probably have a varying knowledge of the global food system and would like to just maybe start with a context question. Right now, today, worldwide, we have two parallel epidemics, one being the obesity epidemic, which today 1.6 billion people are overweight or obese. In the U.S. alone, we have over 60% overweight population. At the same time, we have 1 billion people underweight, even as there is enough food to feed all of these individuals. Clearly, this, I think, hints at a major problem with the modern food system. But Mark, I'd love if you could give just a context of a snapshot of the failures of this modern food system.
Well, you know, some would say there has been no failure, of course, though the what I would refer to as the industrial food system, or the system of food production and distribution that most of us get our food from. Most people would say, wow, well, we're getting more food than we've ever had before, more variety, and it's at a lower price. In the United States, we're spending only 10% of our annual income on food, the lowest in the world. So most people would say, well, what's the problem? Well, I think we, you know, as you alluded to, we have an overconsumption of food and an overconsumption of unhealthy food. In my first book, I used the term food gaps. We have gaps related to people who don't have enough money to buy food, even in light of the fact that we are the wealthiest nation in the country, in the world, and that we have enormous resources, yet we have about 15% of the U.S. population that's considered either hungry or food insecure. We also have people who simply don't have affordable places to be able to buy food that are accessible, places that we call food deserts, neighborhoods and rural areas, of course, where it's very difficult to get to any kind of decent food store. And in some of these places, we're now using the term food swamp to describe a place that's overrun, in effect, by fast food restaurants and convenience stores and places where you can buy all kinds of junk food, but you simply can't buy much in the way of healthy food, particularly fresh fruits and vegetables. So these are the food gaps, and obesity, of course, now at a point where we have, as you said, somewhere close to two-thirds of the U.S. population either overweight or obese. This generation of children may not live as long, be the first generation in the history of this country to not live as long as their parents' generation, and because of obesity and because of diet-related illnesses. So all these problems tend to be compounding one another. But there's another one, and the one that I wanted to really, that I explored more in my new book, Smart Cookin' Mamas, was what I would consider the lack of food democracy, the lack of our ability as citizens to be able to participate in the process of making decisions about the food we're going to eat. Now, we can make those decisions, obviously, as consumers when we have sufficient means and when we have sufficient access, and often also when we have sufficient knowledge. But when it comes to bigger decisions about how that food is being produced and who's controlling the whole process from seed to table, we have very little ability to participate. And I think it's, in fact, I don't know why, it just occurred to me a few weeks ago when I was thinking about this, that we have the opportunity to participate in electing our leaders in this country, but we have the ability to participate in decisions that affect many facets of our lives. But when it comes to the marketplace, and when it comes to the basic decisions that affect the food production and distribution, we have very little opportunity to participate. Democracy really doesn't work that well in the marketplace, where competition is supposedly the guardian angel, and where capitalism rules. So that is sort of the larger context in the U.S. And I'm finding also that this question of food democracy is perhaps more of a global issue. As well, in that nations are either have lost or are in the process of losing their ability to be able to produce food. They become subject to the whims of the industrial food system, and they have become, in fact, recipients of export food from particularly from the United States, such that they have now lost their ability, their skills, their knowledge base to be able to produce food. And the dominance, the sheer dominance of food corporations around the world, even holding aside whether or not the food they are producing and selling is good for you, holding that question aside, the sheer fact that they are so dominant today and have so much ability to influence everything from the decisions that are made at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and I'm pointing over my shoulder because I think that's the right direction, and to, of course, what happens in when Monsanto makes a decision or Archer Daniel Midland makes a decision. And I want to give just one example of that, and then I'll pass the baton. But this was new information that just came to me that I think reflects the basic underlying problem and the challenge of food democracy in the United States. About 2 weeks ago, there was a conference held in Phoenix, Arizona, that was for the chairpersons of the legislative agriculture committees of the states. So all 50 states have, in their legislatures, have some kind of agriculture committee where bills come and are debated and hearings are held on a whole variety of food and farming issues. And so all these chairs from these committees went off for a conference to Phoenix, Arizona. Who paid for the conference? It was Archer Daniel Midland. It was Monsanto. It was a whole array of fertile agrochemical companies, fertilizer companies, and the American Farm Bureau. They actually paid for these people to be at this conference, and they came. And with that kind of access, and with that kind of influence, and with that kind of money, I'm not sanguine about our ability to be able to make food democracy a more common aspect of American political decision-making.
I'll ask Tanya a new question, unless you want to add something to that that very kind of concise overview of the food industry's problems.
No, I think tonight we're not going to debate and fight our positions because we are...
Because I would lose, probably.
I'm in the lucky position I could read your book. Mine has not been translated into English. But I found out we are very much fighting the same battle in the same conditions, talking about food democracy and food sovereignty. The old term used, being used when talking about food and hungry people, was food security, and always meant there were people with having the powers to get some wheat to hungry people and feed the wheat into them. And the new word, people talking about food democracy, is food sovereignty. That means the consumer, a citizen, has the ability to choose himself what he wants to eat, not just by a variety of different candy bars made by big corporations, but also choosing the regional food and knowing where it comes from and knowing how to prepare it. So this is the same context we are fighting for, you in America and me in Europe. And so I was really pleased when I was reading your book to find out, oh, there are so many different initiatives, so many activists all over America having the same problems, fighting the same battles than we do in Europe. And when you were talking about Phoenix, Arizona, the meeting sponsored by all the big corporations, about 10 days ago in Berlin, there was a meeting organized by the Ministry of Consumers, Consumer Protection and Agriculture, and was the Global Forum on Food and Food Security, Fighting Hunger, and it was dominated by all the big corporations. But at the same time, in the streets, there was a big demonstration by people. It were 120 different activist groups, from the Small Farmers Association to people who protect the nature and the ambient, and to people who work for more solidarity with the countries in the South. They all got together, said, we are going to make a demonstration that says the way we do agriculture right now is wrong for nature, is wrong for the animals, and is wrong also for the development agriculture in the poorer countries in the South, where our exports, agricultural experts, ruin the local agriculture. And all these activist groups got together and they made a big demonstration in the streets, and it was really nice to hear all these corporate people sitting and having their discussions within the room with nobody coming in and saying we rule the world. But outside there were all these people in the streets being really angry with what is going on with the food system. So I would like to add to your picture of Phoenix, Arizona, the people, the 22,000 people in Berlin in the streets being angry with the food system right now. And so I would like to bring a bit of the spirit of rebellion to Washington tonight.
Good. Well, consider it done. We've already kind of started to polarize this conversation. Tofu on the one hand, currywurst on the other, food dictatorship on the one hand, food democracy on the other hand. In your book, The Food Dictatorship, you actually paint a picture of the extremes of menus in 2020 or in the future. I would love kind of some of those, that vision that you saw in the book with your conversations with activists, where our future menu could go and where it might go if we don't really engage with our food system and bring it in a new direction.
So, okay, the bad vision might come to us if we don't fight it, might be the real dictatorship, the dictatorship coming even closer. I started in a supermarket when everybody was asking me, why do you call it dictatorship? We are free to buy whatever we want, and we even have access to organic food. And so I took, as an image, I took the consumer to the supermarket into the shelf where the cereals are. And even in Germany, there's a big variety of about 50 different cereals. And if you study the line, what it says about the ingredients to find, it's not high fructose corn syrup, what is in your cereals, but it's sugar and another kind of sugar with another name, just saying sugar and another kind of sugar, and it's wheat or oats or rice. And then all the different varieties are created by artificial colors and by artificial flavors. So this is the freedom. What you have is to choose from artificial colors and flavors, and you're basically eating wheat. And the wheat is the same coming from Russia or coming from Germany or coming from the Midwest United States. So it's the same commodity, and it's impossible to get into a supermarket and ask. I'm standing here in Eastern Westphalia, that's where I'm from, and I want regional perennial wheats and oats and dinkel, which is the old form old form of grain that the organic farmers use. And it's impossible to get it unless you know a farmer on your personally. But you have the freedom of choice of a fake variety. And what might happen in future is that if the big corporations get further control on all the production lines and control on the wire patterns, on the grains, on the seeds, and that's it, then you could get this dictatorship could come closer to you. And the vision is that at the moment people in Europe say we don't want any GMO, and it's really hard to get GMO into Europe, but the moment, the very dangerous moment might be when the corporations find out there is a kind of GMO saying it makes you healthier, because there is a big debate on being healthy, which might be used by big pharma, the big food industry, to get people to persuade people to eat healthy food. And the vision is that the pharmaceutical research is getting together with the big food systems, and they find, let's say a person has a risk for a cardiovascular problem or a diabetes risk or whatever risk or allergy, we are going to develop by pharmaceutical and biotechnology, we're going to develop special food and you can eat it. And as everybody say, you have to live a healthy life, you're going to choose the company that provides you with your special pharmaceutically engineered diet. And this would be, you could not escape from this dictatorship of eating it, because you have to live healthy. You're not going to cause big medical costs, so you're going to have this. And people might not see the danger behind this, because the imperative of living healthy, and of course it's hard to escape from the corporation when there's so much research money going into it, and there are such a lot of activists saying we are watching where the research goes and might go into this direction. And the positive vision is shorter to describe. It's food sovereignty, it's knowing what you eat and choosing what you eat, and it's eating locally, and it's knowing the people who grow the food for you, and it's knowing how to prepare it, and it's appreciating the difference of plants and of animals and of quality that you can see and touch and feel. And it comes very close to what I learned when I went to university in Italy, where people like to talk a lot about food, and even people who are not specially educated but who love to talk about the different tomatoes that are growing in the garden of their grandmother in southern Sicily that are so different from the tomatoes in Tuscany. And they like to talk for hours about what they ate the other evening. And I think this comes very close to appreciating the diversity and of food and preparing it and talking about it. And then you also come to see that food and eating is not a fast food matter of taking it into you to get satisfied while you're running to work or while you're in a hurry, but it's also about a social dimension of food that is going, should be coming back to food. So this would be my positive vision.
Slow food.
It is slow food, yeah.
That actually is a new information. I hadn't heard this pharmaceutical food industry kind of unification. It actually scares me like the movie Soylent Green scares me. Mark, I don't know if you want to add anything to that. Do you see other kind of danger red flags that are on the horizon that really might bring us closer to a food dictatorship?
Yes, I think the way that the food industry it veils itself in the question that it rhetorically asks, which is, who will feed a hungry world, is, to me, the most perhaps insidious way that we are, they are controlling our food system and we are losing control. Because, in fact, as we all know, we're really looking down the twin barrels of a growing population that's supposed to reach 9.5 billion by the year 2050, and by a decline in good arable land. So we're subject to this kind of fear tactic and this question of who will feed a hungry world, because, you know, who among us is going to be able to tell the world and tell industry and tell policymakers that, you know, you shouldn't proceed with new innovations in say, biotechnology or more industrial forms of food production, when in fact we're very worried that starvation is just around the corner. And you know, I find that argument incredibly disingenuous. And the reason that I do is I, doing a little bit of reading by the Nobel laureate economist Amartya Sen, who did a tremendous amount of work on world famine. And he found that in no democratic nation, even in a poor democratic nation, have you ever had a famine. But in authoritarian regimes, such as he used the example of communist China from 1958 to 1961, there was terrible famine. 30 million people died, worst famine in recorded history. And the conclusion, I mean, his absolute, from his analysis, the absolute conclusion really is that if there is a robust debate in the country, if the decision making is transparent, if people are participating in the discourse around how their food system will operate, if there's a free press, you're much less likely, and in his opinion, completely unlikely to have starvation. So the conclusion I reach is we need more of that kind of participation, and we need more of that kind of democracy. We don't need more technology. Why are we being told that we need to, you know, aside from the absurdity of having the kind of the range of products, which are nothing but variations on a single theme, perhaps, we're being told that we need that, you know, that it's necessary to create more technological breakthroughs with our food, and that will make us healthy. I think we all know, everybody in this room, I imagine, knows pretty well what it takes to eat well, to have a healthy diet. And it's unprocessed foods, you know, low on the meat side, high on the plant side. And we don't need more technology to help us figure that out.
Michael Pollan says it well, eat food, yeah, not right. too much, mostly plants. Right? And food means real food, not quotation mark food that they sell in the processed food sections. But yes, that's a great point, Mark. And I think I want to try to pull this now into the how do we bring us to a food democracy. You know, I know, Tanya, you've talked about the role of the consumer. And I want to start there. You know, this we define ourselves more and more in our consumer culture as consumers. But what real power does the consumer have? You mentioned that in a grocery store, our power is pretty limited, and I would say even more so when we have $430 billion of advertising shaping our thinking and our desires. That's worldwide, about half of that in the U.S. alone. Plus, add to that all of the unconscious cues that you have able to manipulate us, whether the size of a plate increasing the amount of food, the larger the plate, the more you eat. That's some classic food psychology. Or the colorful food displays in grocery stores pulling us to buy one thing instead of another. What is the real power of the consumer, and how broad is that power?
I like the word consumer citizen, because it puts on emphasis that we are not only consumers and not only citizens, but that we have to focus on both of the roles, and it's an American term, which I kind of try to introduce into the German debate. So I think we have to start by consuming, and everybody has to realize that whenever he or she buys something, it is also a political choice. It's not just for my own pleasure that I have eat something what I like or not like, but it's also whenever I buy organic milk, I tell the farmer, please produce organic milk. And whenever I buy eggs from hens that are free-range hens, then I say I want the hens to live in that way and not in another way. So this is the beginning. And this was why my first book was on, to say everybody has the power to tell the corporates I want it, or the farmers or whatever, to produce it this way. And my book appeared in 2006, and that was at the same time when the Lohas movement came over from America, and famous Hollywood artists told us, or told the audience, well, it matters what you care, and you can use organic cattle, and you can have organic food, and you can live healthy, and you do yourself good. At the same time, you help others. So this is the consumer power, which is getting more and more powerful by celebrities promoting it and talking about this kind of lifestyle, and many more people copying it and thinking, okay, I don't actually want animals kept in factory-like farms for all their life, so I won't buy this anymore. But it is important to say that this is only the beginning, and it's really important not to say the consumers can change the world, so we don't need any government, we don't need no policy. It is really important to say the consumer has to be a critical, ethical consumer, and he has to ask for another policy. And that begins with a very important point, which I think in Europe we are in a lucky position to have more access to information. So that is the right to ask for what you're getting. And in what happened to when GMO was plants were introduced in America, you all didn't know about it because it was in the fields and there was no sign on the product saying it's GMO, contains GMO. So I remember there was a survey made by a university asking people, would you like to eat GMO? And they said, I would not like to eat GMO. And they didn't even know they had been eating it because they didn't have the choice. And in Germany, people heard about this very intransparent introduction of GMO. And now we achieved the duty of every producer to write it contains GMO or it does not contain GMO. Keine Gentechnik, it would be in German, on the milk and on the meat and whatever. And the consumers, every survey says, every study says the consumers in Europe don't want GMO. And so it's nearly impossible to sell. Nestle tried to introduce the Butterfinger into the European shelves, and they had to sign it contains GMO corn, and it was impossible to sell it. So this shows the consumer power is big, but it's only big and in the connection with the right to know. And that's what I think you have, and we all have to fight for, is the right to know what is in the products we buy and how it was produced and who is behind it. And so the consumer has the power, but he has also the duty to ask for better politics, to be a consumer and a citizen at the same time.
Mark,
could I ask her a question?
Oh, sure.
It appears to me that there is, in fact, more democracy in Europe than in the United States. Now, you mentioned protests when a decision was made, right, in Germany. And we've had many decisions here. Recently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says it's okay to use genetically engineered alfalfa, which is going to have a big, big impact on agriculture. We didn't have any protests. Of course, we blogged a lot. we got on the keyboard and we were pounding those keys, but we didn't get out on the streets. You did get on the streets. And, you know, what do you think is different?
That's a good question, because when you said when you said that I said we had more democracy, I shrugged because I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. I think GMO started in the USA. We had the advantage of seeing what is happening there, and so we were prepared to what might come to us. So that was the difference there. And I'm not sure if we can say that we have generally more food democracy.
Well, are citizens more active?
I actually don't know what made it, but GMO was a real big issue because so many consumers said we don't know what it is. It sounds really difficult to us. And then we really had a lot of profit from all the activists in the U.S. There are a lot of books written in GMO. They were translated into German, and then we knew what was going on and what was happening. And then there was really what only happened recently is that all these concerned consumers talk together to the small farmers saying, okay, we all know what happened to Percy Schmeisser in Canada. We don't want this to happen. And this also affected the farmers, the conventional farmers that are no not fighting for organic agriculture, but they understood this is my field, and I feel this is this is my own field, and I want the right to do what I used to do, like my fathers, my ancestors did. And this was a strong feeling that when a farmer might pay for something that he owns and gets into danger, this kind of mobilized the farmers, and so they united with the consumers. But still, we have, at the same time, we have very strong corporate influence on the European decision authorities. There's this famous EFSA authority, which is the European Food Security Authority in Italy. And there were the director changed to a big corporation, on GMO corporation, so there are revolving doors and personal connections. So I don't know what the difference is there. We have the same problems with a lot of political influence by these corporates, but the consumers, on this point, they are fighting back.
Good.
Before I open it up to the audience, I do want to ask one last question. We're talking a lot of policy, a lot of heavy stuff, but I know, Mark, your newest book really talks about these food pioneers who are really working in their area, whether in farming or in educating, mm-hmm. and all of that, to really shift this system and to bring about food democracy. I'd love just a few stories to really ground this conversation a little bit.
Yeah, I know. We probably sound like we're just giving you one big bummer up here. But in fact, I think most of how many people here, for instance, shop at a farmer's market in Washington? I thought a lot of you did, just lucky guess. How many of you are active gardeners in some way? Yeah. So you're pretty much tuned in. We're probably preaching to the choir, except for that person in the back who I think works for Monsanto. I'm not sure. But there is incredible amount of good news, as all of you know, in spite of the gloom and doom picture that we're painting. And it comes from individuals and organizations and communities at a very personal level, a very kind of a household level. And that's what I write about in my story, are people who I kind of consider my real life, food action figures. Somebody like Maurice Small, who is been starting community gardens and urban farms all across northern Ohio, particularly in Cleveland. A young guy that he grew up in the housing projects of Cleveland. He got tired of seeing the same vacant lots as an adult that he saw and grew up with as a child. He just got kind of mad and motivated at the same time and started bringing his neighbors together, one lot at a time, clearing rubble, getting permission to use the lot, getting resources to plant, borrowing a rototiller. I mean, it was kind of a Johnny Appleseed story in an urban setting around community gardening. And it's a wonderful sort of complicated story of one person joining with others and building something pretty special over time and having a partnership at the same time with the city of Cleveland, which has a food policy council, which is one way I have found that we've been able to get to this question of food democracy, is to actually create citizen groups that are going to be active at a local and state level. And the support he received from this Cleveland group to change the zoning laws to allow more gardens, actually provide a little bit of economic development assistance so that people could actually create some small urban farms. Then using the buying power, the purchasing power of the city of Cleveland, which was buying food for its public institutions, to give a preference to the food that's produced both in the city and right just outside. So, I mean, it's those kinds of initiatives, usually in partnership with nonprofit organizations and local government, that I think are making a difference. And my smart cooking mamas are low-income moms in Austin, Texas, who are in a program called the Happy Kitchen. And these were women, all women, who decided one day that they had to change their lives. Many of them were scared by the fact that they were overweight, obese. Diabetes was just around the corner. Their parents had been or diabetic. They saw their children becoming overweight, and they took action. They decided that they had to do something to change their lives, and they found this program that basically taught them how to buy food, buy healthy food, inexpensive, and taught them how to prepare it. A peer-led program, being taught by people like them who went through the program, learned how to cook, lost weight, made their lives better, and then went on to share those skills with others. And, you know, the thing that I saw, and I interviewed, when I spent several days in Austin, I interviewed about 30 women, and the story and the attitude that I picked up time and time again was, I was scared, I had to make a change, I found the gumption to do that, I found help to do that, and I feel better. I feel better about myself. And they had this incredible self-confidence and improved self-esteem as a result of this simple, relatively simple process of learning how to buy food, eat healthfully, cook well, and learn, teach their children how to eat broccoli without covering it in Cheese Whiz. So, you know, those are the kind, many, many stories, many people like that. But, you know, I'm not a person who really is kind of an up by the bootstraps, you know, you can do it yourself type of person. I think that is, you know, it's part of the American mythology, and it does work from time to time. But I think all of us get some help in one way or another, and it's that kind of appropriate level of helping, I think, that, and when people are ready, that we begin to pull ourselves up and really make some changes.
But just one quick follow-up. As those programs have been established by those pioneers, do you see then increasing kind of effectiveness? You know, as there were a few smart cooking mamas, did that end up generating more social capital and a larger number of?
It did. And now there are hundreds. In fact, I think there are thousands of smart cooking mamas. But, and this is an important but, just in that one community, they need tens of thousands of smart cooking mamas because the threat is huge. And they just don't have the resources to be able to provide enough training and instruction to those number of people. And what they would love to do, and nobody sees it happening anytime soon, would be to integrate this kind of program into the public school curriculum so that every child in the city of Austin, every child in the United States would graduate from high school with some kind of certificate of food competency. And you know, we'd actually learn once again how to cook. You know, kids would learn how to hold a knife. They'd learn how to chop vegetables. They'd learn how to hold a whisk. They'd learn all these things that, and it's a really small investment in comparison to the last number I saw, most recent study, showed was the $300 billion of additional healthcare costs in this country due to obesity. $300 billion. You know, we will never get healthcare costs under control if we don't get obesity under control.
That's great. And the microphone. Very inspiring idea, too.